Good morning. I'm sorry, I have very bad news for someone. There is a blue Dodge van on this side of the building that has its lights on. You don't have to be embarrassed. You can get up and turn the lights off. This coming Thursday, day after tomorrow, David Sachs, who wrote a charming history of the alphabet, will be here for a sort of Unmiller Center-esque program, but it should be very entertaining and a nice change from politics and 9/11. Next Monday, we are having a conference on the question of fair elections. Can fair elections be held? We have four speakers who will talk about terrorist threats, about the work that the Commission on Election Reform did in the year 2001 on suppression and intimidation of voters and on some of the administrative mechanical problems like touchscreen voting and will there be receipts for voting and some of that cluster of issues. In addition to our normal mailing list, we've invited election officials from all around the state to come, so we hope that that will be useful and informative. For many years, people have been aware of the CIA's involvement in the covert wars in Afghanistan that fueled Islamic militancy and gave rise to bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. Understanding how all that happened, however, has proven to be very difficult. Stephen Call undertook the job of straightening this out, and there could be no better person to do it. Steve, who is now managing editor of the Washington Post, has been a reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor at the Post since 1985. Early in 1987, after writing a book about the oil industry and the world of hostile corporate takeovers on Wall Street, he became the Post's financial correspondent in New York, where he covered the stock market crash and the Ivan Boesky and Mike Milken investigations. He won with David Vise the Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for explanatory journalism. In 1989, he moved to New Delhi to become the Post South Asia correspondent. For 3 years, at that very critical time, he covered India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other areas during various revolutions, insurgencies, natural disasters. He also reported from the Middle East, and in 1992, he won the Livingston Award for Outstanding International Reporting. In the summer of 1995, he was appointed editor of the Post magazine. In 96, he was appointed publisher of the magazine as well, overseeing all of its editorial and business operations. He became, in short, a committed bureaucrat. In 1998, he was appointed managing editor of the newspaper and has held that position ever since. Although recently he has announced that he will be stepping aside as managing editor of the paper at the end of this year to allow him to return to his first passion, reporting and writing books. Steve is the author of five books. He was born in Washington. Graduated Phi Beta Kappa with a degree in English and history from Occidental College in Los Angeles. Please join me in welcoming Steve Call.
Thank you very, very much. I'm delighted to be here. Good morning. I'm not used to doing this sitting down, but I'll improvise if my voice is a little raspy. I think it was about 10 hours ago that with my two teenage children, I staggered out of FedEx Field after yet another dispiriting defeat by the Washington Redskins at the hands of the Dallas Cowboys. So I'm still recovering from that. I'm barely recovered from my last appearance at the University of Virginia in May, which I enjoyed, but I appeared before the Jefferson Society, which I guess is a student speaking organization that invites people like me down. And it was a terrific group of very bright young students. But I'll tell you a quick story about it. I was about 15 minutes into my talk when one of the students suffered a grand mal seizure sitting in the audience. I don't know if you've ever witnessed such an event, but it's an awful thing. And a student who was a second-year medical student at University of Virginia sprung to his feet and came to the front and took just extraordinary care of this young man and got on a cell phone, called the ambulance, spoke to the paramedics as they came, made certain that the young man was very well taken care of, and he was, of course, fine, as is often the case with such seizures. But largely through the through the attention that this medical student paid. Afterwards, we were standing around outside recovering from all of this, and the medical student remarked, well, there was a certain irony in that, wasn't there, he said to another friend. I said, well, what was that about? It turned out the victim was on the examining board of the society, and the medical student was an applicant. And in order to win, in order to win admission to the society, you have to successfully present an argument. And he had 2 weeks before gone to this particular student, the victim, to attempt to make an argument. And the victim had rejected the medical student's topic as not serious enough to be worthy of the society's attention. And I said, well, what was the topic? I swear. He said that it was, I guess the arguments have a form, to be resolved, or let it be resolved, that all public places should contain medical resuscitation equipment. So I guess the lesson is that, I don't know, that we who sit in judgment should drink a grande cup of humility every morning, and that's probably a pretty good preface to this brief talk about the origins of September 11th as they were located in Afghanistan, which is the subject of my recent journalism and a lot of my professional life. I became interested in trying to pull this together into a book largely because I had been in the region between 1989 and 1992. I'd spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and in Pakistan as a correspondent for the paper, and I think I had a small reputation among my colleagues for being obsessed with Pakistani intelligence and the sort of structure of the Afghan conflict. This was at a time when the conflict was fading in importance for many Americans because the Soviet Union had withdrawn and was on the verge of cracking up, and Afghanistan was devolving into a more regional issue. But for a correspondent for the Washington Post, it was still a good story because U.S. policy was at issue. There was quite a lot of debate about what U.S. policy should be, and even if your stories ran on A22, the great thing about being a correspondent for the Post was that you knew there were at least 500 people in Washington who every morning got up and were paid to read your story as part of their jobs. And so you could file on all sorts of incremental minutiae and feel satisfied that you were making some contribution. In the time I have available this morning, I'm not going to try to encapsulate the 20-year history that I tried to sketch and wrestle with in this particular book, but I'll try to give you some flavor of it, humbled by the presence of some people in the front row who know a lot more about it than I do. And in the course of giving you a taste of it, I'll try to draw out some themes that perhaps can stimulate your questions when we turn to them in about 25 or 30 minutes. Let me start with a story that one of our guests today, Philip Zelica, who is the staff director of the 9/11 Commission, alluded to in the hallway, which is one of my favorite episodes from the history, the antecedents of 9/11, much of it hidden until recent work by the Commission, which is a story that unfolds in February of 1999 when Osama bin Laden apparently decided to go falcon hunting. At the time, he was moving around Afghanistan trying to make himself scarce. He spent a fair amount of time in and around Kandahar, where members of his family sometimes lived at a compound outside the airport. And apparently in February 1999, he joined a falcon hunting party that had arrived from the Persian Gulf that intended to hunt for bustard, which is a seasonal bird of prey, popular hunting sport for Bedouins in the Gulf. And bin Laden had grown up in the tradition of falcon hunting in Saudi Arabia, and there are accounts of him participating in such hunts even before this as the guest of Taliban and other Pakistani-Afghan sheikhs. So evidently he goes out into the deserts south of Kandahar, and what he doesn't know is that he's being tracked by a group of paid agents of the CIA, a group of Afghans who had worked for the agency in the 80s and had been recruited back onto the payroll for the purposes of following bin Laden around Afghanistan in the hope that they could pinpoint his location exactly enough to create an opportunity for the president or perhaps themselves to launch an attack against bin Laden for the purposes of capturing or killing him. So by the account that's now, I think, fully transparent on the public record because of the excellent work of the commission, both in assembling it and declassifying it, we now know that these agents followed bin Laden to this hunting camp complex, because there was more than one camp in the same area. They put themselves up on a ridge overlooking the camp, by accounts that I heard about this incident, and they had the kind of equipment that allowed them to establish their exact location in GPS coordinates, which allowed the agency to put satellites up and photograph what they claimed to be describing. And what they described was an elaborate camp with multiple tents and apparently generators, and next to it a C-130 that had flown in. And when the camouflage pattern and tail numbers of the C-130 were analyzed, it appeared that the plane had originated with the government of the United Arab Emirates, an oil-producing ally of the United States, a very important source of basing rights for American naval ships in the Persian Gulf. The report that bin Laden was at this camp set off what we now understand to have been about a week, 10 days worth of discussions held in secret in the Clinton White House's National Security Group about whether it made sense to launch cruise missiles against this camp or otherwise attack it for the purposes of killing bin Laden and disrupting al-Qaeda's leadership. February 1999, remember, is 6-7 months after the August embassy bombings, which bring al-Qaeda's intention to attack American targets into plain light and stimulate covert action attempts by the Clinton administration to capture or kill him and some other selected leaders around him. And what's interesting about this episode is, to me, I think the most interesting thing about it, and the theme that I'd like to tease out a little bit, is the layers of complexity associated with the decision-making that unfold in these 7 to 10 days. First of all, there's the question of, is bin Laden really there? I say apparently, because I don't think anybody really knows other than bin Laden. And what we do know is that these agents were 120% certain that he was there. But one of the discussions between the president and his national security advisors was whether their certainty was adequate to justify a launch of missiles in these circumstances. And the CIA had to make clear that they had no second source, as we would say in my business. They had no independent second source. They had lots of people in the same group saying the same thing, but they didn't have a second thread. So that was one question. Echoes today in many cases that we've unraveled involving Iraq and other places. Is one source good enough? When is one source good enough? How much risk are you willing to take for how much reward? So there's one source of complexity. Another involves the presence of this airplane. What does it mean? It wouldn't have been shocking to people well informed to think that some members of the royal families, and there are more than one of them in the United Arab Emirates, might have been sympathetic enough with the Taliban or with bin Laden-affiliated groups in Afghanistan to go hunting in proximity to someone like bin Laden. But who was there? How significant were they? How had they acquired use of these apparent government assets? What would the consequences have been if they had been struck? Would it have been justifiable and sustainable and defensible politically to kill bin Laden and members of the royal family of the United Arab Emirates, a royal family of the United Arab Emirates? Even if so, you had to calculate the possibility that you could miss bin Laden and kill members of the royal family of the United Arab Emirates, since the information was that uncertain. And then, finally, one last layer of complexity. It's February 1999, and because of the dates that the commission has now graciously put on the record, I only had sort of seasonal approximations when this had occurred and was quite cautious in my writing about claiming when it had occurred. Now we know exactly when it had occurred, and we know that it occurred in the 5 or 6 working days leading up to the Saturday on which President Clinton faced his trial and impeachment in the Senate. In fact, he was acquitted that Saturday, and he would have had reason to believe in the days before that he would be acquitted because the politics was lining up that way, but launching a cruise missile attack days before such an event would have been quite an injection of risk and uncertainty into that week of politics. So these discussions go on. The decision is made to pass. There's quite a lot of anger at the middle working levels of the CIA and others involved in reporting on bin Laden's movements, who feel that a rare opportunity to find bin Laden sitting still for a while has been missed because he moves around quite a lot. He practices, even today, as we know, very intensive security about his location. And so there was quite a lot of resonance about this decision to stand down. Fast forward a year very quickly to early 2000. This is in the immediate aftermath of the millennium period. You remember the turn of the year 2000 as a time of anxiety in the United States. Many of us were focused more on computers than terrorism, to be honest, but those in the government who knew better were warning about the potential for multiple al-Qaeda attacks as 2000 approached. And indeed, in December, you'll recall an alert customs officer in the state of Washington stopped a car coming off a ferry from Canada, noticed that the man at the wheel seemed to be unaccountably nervous, had the wit to pull him aside, looked in his vehicle and found explosives that Ahmed Rassam, an Algerian, later said he intended to use to attack the Los Angeles airport. That set off a heightened sense of alert and multiple attempts, both in the open and clandestinely, to try to disrupt al-Qaeda before they could launch the attacks that we now know they intended to launch, 3, that one, another in Jordan, and a third against a U.S. warship in Aden, using the same method that was later used against the USS Cole. This was an attack that was meant to hit the USS the Sullivans. The skiff loaded with suicide bombers and explosives was floated out into the harbor that January and apparently just sank under the weight of the explosives. And it took them 9 months to figure out how to get the weight right and relaunch. In any event, it was in this context that the CIA received a report of uncertain provenance that bin Laden would appear at a camp in eastern Afghanistan called Durunta, which is a place near Jalalabad, well known to the Americans because Ahmed Rassam, among others, had trained there. It was sort of a graduate school for al-Qaeda operatives, and there were reports that, among other things besides advanced explosives work, that there might have been some chemical weapons or some poison training going on there. It certainly was a place of interest, and the idea that bin Laden would appear there was of interest. And certainly, at least by the account that I have, which I can't vouch for absolutely, there's less rich documentation about this episode than about the hunting camp episode, certainly at least in the 9/11 Commission report. But the account that I have is that this report about bin Laden's appearance at Durunta was relayed in early 2000 to intelligence aides, to Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Tajik commander in northern Afghanistan who had fought with imagination against the Soviet Union, and who in 1999, after some running contact with the United States, agreed to cooperate on intelligence matters against bin Laden with the CIA. Massoud was fighting an existential war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda in northern Afghanistan, and while he was bottled up in the north and not operating in many of the areas where bin Laden was present, his lines did extend toward Jalalabad, and he had ample motivation, in any event, to fight against bin Laden and the Taliban, since he was doing so every day. And he had decided to cooperate on intelligence matters with the CIA for the purpose of locating bin Laden. Perhaps the agency wanted Massoud to launch what Massoud's aides called a Hollywood operation to capture bin Laden using helicopters. And so they had these discussions about cooperation. And so this report goes out to Massoud saying bin Laden's going to make an appearance at Durunta, he's going to make a speech, and Massoud orders a commando group to approach their southernmost lines, climb a ridge, and lob Soviet-made Katyusha rockets into this camp in the hope that they will, they advertise, hit bin Laden in the middle of his speech. And they send a report back to Langley saying they've undertaken this measure. And the report circulates inside the building. Now, as a journalist, one of the sort of challenges of working on this project was to try to get a grip on what the CIA is, how it operates, what its internal culture is. And it took me a long while to get a sense of the place. But one of the discoveries I made as a bureaucrat running an organization with 800 independent-minded reporters in it was that there's a kind of universal grammar of bureaucracy, that all bureaucracies are essentially the same, especially when they're made up of independent-minded liberal arts graduates. And one of the characteristics, I often would make some reporting breakthrough in my efforts to try to get a grip on the agency, and then I would say, oh yeah, I recognize, this is just like the Washington Post, I know that guy. And one of the characteristics, it seems to me, of the Department of Agriculture probably, and certainly the Washington Post, and at least in this case the CIA these days, is that people like to copy email to each other. Everybody circulates everything, and the technology makes it possible to circulate messages all around. And in this case, the news that this attack had been launched against Durunta was copied all around the agency, and it went to the General Counsel's office. And at least by the account that I have, the lawyers were alarmed that they came down to the Counterterrorist Center, which was running the liaison with Massoud, and they said, in effect, you guys are out of bounds. As we interpret the authorities the president has granted you, you are permitted to cooperate with Massoud for the purpose of collecting intelligence about bin Laden's location so that the national command authorities can make a decision about whether to attack him. But you're not authorized to provide him information to independently attack Massoud under the same authorities. And you may be over the line here, and you may face consequences as a result of this. So dismayed, they flash a message out to Massoud saying, we may have overstepped our authority. Will you withdraw this mission? And Massoud's people say in reply, you know, you're out of your minds. First of all, these people are walking. They're on mules. They have no radios. I can't call them back. And secondly, you need to decide what it is you really want to do in Afghanistan, because we really don't have a general counsel's department out here. We can't interpret these sorts of nuances. You know, the incident passed without consequence, as it happened. Perhaps bin Laden never turned up. Massoud reported they shelled the place. Who knows? Lest anyone believe that this kind of complexity is solely a product of a pre-9/11 mindset or the Clinton administration or other hypotheses about it, I'd urge you to read Tommy Frank's new memoir, American Soldier, which contains an account of his own personal role flying a Predator operation against Mullah Omar in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, where he was sitting at a table taking advantage of the technology that allows an operator or a commander to fly a Predator drone armed with air-to-ground missiles from a remote location and to, in real time, track a target on the ground and decide whether to shoot. And Frank's account is extraordinary because he is chasing a convoy involved with Mullah Omar in it all around southern Afghanistan, as you would, as your teenage friends or children or grandchildren would do with a video game. And to his left is a JAG lawyer. And around him are representatives of each of the service chiefs. He paints the picture almost as if you're in one of those operating theaters where they bring in the students to watch you perform the heart surgery. And he's aware of sort of being second-guessed from every angle. And he's flying this Predator above the convoy, and he gets the convoy stops. And each time he considers shooting, he turns to the JAG and he says, "Any issues?" And the JAG will say, "No issues," or, "Yes, there's an issue, sir. The authorities contemplate limitation of collateral damage. I interpret this building as being out of bounds for those reasons." There's this amazing moment where the convoy stops, everybody decamps, goes into a mosque. The JAG and even Franks recognizes he's not going to hit the mosque, but they're sort of stumped because this is as good a shot as they've had. And so they come up with the idea of shooting the missile just 50 yards outside the mosque to frighten everybody, have them run outside, and then they'll shoot them. And they actually do this. Everyone runs outside. Then nobody thinks to look up, which is an interesting part of the story. Why has there been this huge explosion? But they don't shoot again. They get them in convoys. They chase them into an urban area. And ultimately, because they're in an urban area where it's not possible to shoot, the convoy escapes. One of the things that Frank says in concluding his narration of this episode is that he knew as soon as it was over that a version of this was going to be leaked to the press, emphasizing his incompetence, because all of these rival service chiefs had been scrutinizing his decision-making with skeptical eyes throughout, and that he could just feel that they were going to use this to try to undermine his own and CENTCOM's authority over the conduct of the war. Really remarkable. I guess, you know, stop with the anecdotes and start with the themes. What patterns are woven through this? One, of course, is the complexity and the difficulty of waging war under the rule of law against an enemy that doesn't recognize the rule of law, an enemy that is not a state, not an army, and whose professed goals involve the taking of mass civilian casualties in the United States in order to shock the United States into changing its policies, I suppose would be the best way to encapsulate bin Laden's articulated ideology. Certainly, taking mass casualties in the United States, a kind of nihilism, is part of his outlook, and he does not recognize any of the transparency or law that creates the complexity that we've just described. I think another theme in a lot of these episodes is who is the enemy and how much risk are you prepared to take in recognizing that enemy? Because to me, one of the recurring themes in the history inside Afghanistan that leads you up to 9/11 is the instinct, again and again, almost unconscious, in the United States to narrow the definition of the problem so as to make it manageable. And certainly in the late 1990s, we see this in the case of the Taliban, where this whole series of episodes, such as the two I've described and many others that you can read about in the 9/11 Commission report, reflect a definition of the enemy as a very narrow al-Qaeda leadership group operating in isolation from Afghanistan's civil war, its humanitarian crises, the failure of its state, the regional conflict in which the civil war is occurring, the support of Pakistani intelligence for the Taliban and al-Qaeda, the proselytizing and fundraising that al-Qaeda does in the Persian Gulf. The whole complex of the war is out of bounds. It's too much politically and too challenging for American foreign policy at that time. There's no context for an invasion of Afghanistan, Sandy Berger said again and again in explaining this history. It's hard to argue with that observation. What was the context for an invasion of Afghanistan in 1999? I suppose it would have taken only the Churchillian sort of 1930s recognition that bin Laden meant what he said and that the only way to stop him would have been to move earlier and more decisively, but that sort of leadership is really quite rare, and it goes back to this question of who really is the enemy. Is it just bin Laden, or is it the context in which he thrives? I think that these questions are still alive, all of them, today, and I think that any careful reading of what's happening now in what we commonly call the war on terrorism suggests that many of these questions are unresolved, despite a sort of rhetorical air of confidence that they have been. And I think that that's something worth chewing on, and I hope that it's an observation that's alive in the councils of government where it matters more than here. Let me just finish by stepping a little bit further back and talking a little about the history of Afghanistan that created the context for all of these episodes and these dilemmas. I believe that you really can't understand how we arrived at where we were in 1999 and 2000 until you go back to 1979 and carefully walk forward from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. A horrible miscalculation by the Politburo that we now, from access to Politburo records, understand was an accident, or at least a stupid mistake that they themselves recognized was likely to fail, and which they undertook out of ignorance and desperation. It was a horrible moral and humanitarian crisis that they unleashed, gave rise to a just and popular resistance among broad numbers of Afghans, and the United States, along with many other nations, individuals, and institutions, poured in to assist the resistance out of many calculations at the same time, but the geopolitical one being to raise the costs of the Soviet invasion initially. That was the goal. Later, to reverse the Soviet invasion when that seemed possible. And one of the sort of structural characteristics of this period during the 1980s was the extent to which the United States relied on the Pakistan Army as its partner. In part, maybe in large part, and we have people here who can illuminate some of this more directly than myself, because the Pakistan Army insisted on it. They wouldn't work any other way, but also because there was a recognition that our interest in this conflict, especially early in the 1980s, involved the harassment and confrontation with the Soviet Union and not Afghanistan per se. And I think one reading of this history involves the extent to which that approach gathered its own momentum and was not re-examined later when there was an opportunity to ask whether that approach now ought to be abandoned for a more risky and uncertain engagement with Afghanistan as an Afghanistan. I think there probably was an opportunity in the late 80s and early 1990s to attempt to construct something like a center in post-war Afghanistan, attempt to isolate the extremists who had been promoted in the late stages of the war. Would such an attempt have succeeded? Unlikely, not impossible. What would it have been about? It would have been about the construction of a coalition in Afghanistan that would have resembled much what we have, what the bond process produced, and a confederation of moderate royalist Pashtuns, northern ethnic militias, and exiled intellectuals, bolstered by a lot of money poured in from the outside and a lot of security poured in from the outside, in the hope that they could have stabilized the center, isolated the extremists, created a context for normalization over time. Whether such a thing could have worked 10 years before it was attempted is impossible to know, but it's the only window that I can identify in the history from that period. What becomes the case, of course, is a vacuum rises in Afghanistan in the early 1990s, and the Taliban fill it. And the only thing that I would say quickly about the Taliban is that I don't believe it's possible to understand their claims on national power in Afghanistan except to recognize that they are an extension of the ambitions of the Pakistan Army to quell Afghanistan through the promotion of a unifying Islamist militia. For Pakistan, Afghanistan is an unruly Western neighbor, threatens to break up its own nation state by promoting Pashtun nationalism, threatens to give India yet another platform to challenge Pakistan. And the army, Zia first, generations of officers later, convinced themselves that the best way to solve the Afghan problem was through Islamic radical unity. And the Taliban were merely an extension of a strategy that was 15, 20 years old. They were a regional movement. They are a regional movement. I don't believe they could have ever have attained or even aspired to national power without the extensive support that they received from the Pakistan government. So when we talk about the Taliban today, I think that's an important context for understanding them. So let me just finish by going back to this question of who is the enemy and how much risk are you prepared to take. I do think that by the time you get to 1999, where we began with this hunting trip, any American who took a very serious tour of the Afghan and regional landscape at that time would have defined serious anti-American interests much more broadly than our politics and our government defined the campaign at that hour. And why that was so at the time is in some ways easy to explain and hard to fathom at the same time. And you look now at this divided moment in American life where the center is so badly eroded and the country is so sharply polarized. And you feel again that this question of whether there is a national appetite to think about who is the enemy and how to define the campaign is again waning, some now for different reasons, but for related ones. And that's a question that I'd be interested to hear from you on as we now turn to your questions. Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it.
Would like to ask the first question. Yes, sir.
Please wait for the microphone.
Thank you. I want to thank you for an excellent synopsis of the background of what led up to the present situation. But to fast forward to the present, could you tell us approximately the number of American and non-American troops in Afghanistan today, and how they are distributed geographically in dangerous versus peaceful areas, and how do the numbers compare to commitments made by the different countries?
Okay. Let's see. I think there are approximately, I'm only hesitating because of the pop quiz nature of the numbers. I think there's about 20 to 25,000 troops overall in Afghanistan, of whom approximately 7 to 10,000 are NATO and the remainder are Americans. The American deployment has surged in anticipation of the election. I could be off by 10 or 15%. That's a rough figure. The troops are deployed. The NATO troops have the stabilization function primarily. They're mainly in the cities. The American troops have a Taliban and Al-Qaeda hunting function. They're mainly based in Kandahar. And the Marines are there now. That role is morphing into trying to create stability for the elections. The NATO commitments are short of what a number of governments have promised, but not a total abdication of the scale that was contemplated at Bonn, I think would be fair to say. The big question there, the forest for those trees, is whether the footprint strategy in Afghanistan was right. In effect, the special operations forces and paramilitary approach to the war that produced this lightning victory between September and December of 2001 yielded a stabilization regime that emphasized a light international footprint in order to avoid stimulating resistance by Afghans who had shown an unruly disrespect for foreign armies in the past. And some people argued that a larger footprint was required to create the stability that Afghanistan will need for 10 or 15 years in order to recover. Others argue that this was just about the right balance. The election is an important turning point. To date, the security situation is unsettled but impressive overall, certainly by recent Afghan standards. We'll see. The Taliban haven't proven much potency so far, though obviously the several scores of their victims are an indication that they haven't gone away.
Fred Hitz was Inspector General of the CIA and presently teaches at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Virginia and in the law school. Fred?
Hi, Steve. Wonderful book. I hope we put a couple of dimes in your pocket because we've assigned it for these two courses. My question is about Khan and the revelations and tapping your extensive knowledge of that Pakistani situation. When did we know about it? It looks to me to have been a terrific coup, as at least announced in the last few months, that we've discovered it and identified all of its tentacles. But do you have any feeling yourself from your own researches how long ago we might have known about that and what sort of arrangements we made to sort of either live with it, gather more information about it, whatever?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define the it, because if the it is Pakistani proliferation of nuclear weapons or uranium enrichment technology by state or semi-state channels, that's a story that goes back as far as the Pakistani program. And there were even episodes of Pakistani contacts that were ambiguous as to how sanctioned they were with Iran in the late 80s, which we now understand to have been part of the fountainhead of the whole Khan story, that he began to conceive of himself as a proliferator with a suite of motivations that included nationalism, religious nationalism, and greed. That this sort of sense of himself began in the mid-80s when elements of the army, like General Aslam Beg, had contacts with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards and others And there were talks about nuclear bargains, particularly involving uranium enrichment, which was the one thing that Khan knew. Remember, who is A.Q. Khan? A.Q. Khan is a thief, isn't he? I mean, he is a centrifuge specialist who walked out of a Dutch uranium consortium called Urenco with the blueprints to Urenco's centrifuge technology. He then brought it to Pakistan and helped Pakistan acquire the enrichment capability that it used to build its bomb. So he's always had this slightly roguish history. To get to the real sort of business of it, what he did in the late 1990s, flying around the world with a Sri Lankan middleman in Dubai, clients in Libya, North Korea, perhaps Syria, elsewhere, and then using the proceeds to acquire for himself hotels in places like Mali on a Pakistani Air Force plane. It's a, if you wrote this as fiction, you know, you would be badly reviewed as implausible, I think. And a couple of the big threshold questions: is it reasonable to believe that Khan was flying to some of these destinations on a Pakistan Air Force plane without the knowledge of the core commanders of the Pakistan Army? No, it's not reasonable to believe that. Are there aspects of his dealings that look like direct state deals, such as his swap with North Korea? Yeah, I think so. Are there others that look like they were privatized abuses of his privileged position? Probably. It's a blend. This is the business of Pakistan that is so maddening. The state isn't coherent enough to confront as an entity. It's made up of all of these different layers. And his story kind of takes you right through the dangerous center of the unstable Pakistani state.
Yes, sir. There are a group of students here who have been studying ghost wars, and I would have been terribly disappointed if you all hadn't posed at least one question.
Good morning, and thank you. You mentioned the upcoming election in Afghanistan and hopefully in January in Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about, the United States sort of has a checkered past being involved in foreign elections. Do you feel like, would it be beneficial for us to be involved either overtly or covertly through the CIA and having a horse in these races?
No, wouldn't be beneficial. There's nothing at stake that would justify or require such an intervention in, certainly not in Afghanistan. Iraq is a little bit of a mess right now and hard to forecast what problems the elections will present. But in Afghanistan, it's a mixed picture and I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, but I'm sort of optimistic about Afghanistan. I don't read the current situation as a crisis or a failure. I think this is a country that has been obliterated by 20 years of war and that is rising on its own accord in substantial part to try to set a new course. And while, for instance, the violence that the Taliban has mounted is serious and has the potential to be even more serious as a source of instability, the truth is that Afghanistan, on the whole, has stabilized, avoided the kinds of conflicts that might have occurred, concentrated on reconstruction and rebuilding. There's a collective sense of exhaustion and hope in the country simultaneously, and these elections are an expression of that. They really, I think, the glass is half full there. And all the elections really need to do is to provide another basis for the beginning. A stable Afghanistan is a 10 to 20 year project. To think that somehow one democratic election is going to be a decisive event in the course of that project is, I think, wrong, but it's an important step as long as it feels like it's leaning forward and not backward. I would conclude just by saying that it doesn't really trouble me, for instance, that there was a wonderful little brief in the newspaper the other day about a tribe in the southeast that had apparently, the headline on the brief was, now I forget the name, the Turanzai paid for this ad, quoting what American politicians are required. And apparently they had put out a message on the radio saying that all members of the Turanzai tribe are required to vote for Hamid Karzai. And if they do not, the tribe will come and burn their houses down. All right, well, that's constituency politics of a kind that, you know, in an old Chicago, some people might have recognized, but it's a beginning. It's, you know, let's vote as a group, but at least let's vote. So, you know, in 20 years, maybe there will be a dissenting faction of the Turnside tribe that represents, that starts a political party that campaigns on issues. But for now, this is where we are.
Question came in from one of the overflow rooms. In your opinion, to what extent do the roots of 9/11 lead back to United States foreign policy, covert and otherwise? Are we our own enemy?
That's such a huge question. I don't think that 9/11 is the result of American foreign policy. 9/11 is the result of bin Laden's ambitions and his sort of crazed vision of how mass civilian casualties might shock the West into changing its policies in the Middle East. I think that American foreign policy created some of the context in which al-Qaeda rose and bin Laden found sanctuary to carry out his ambitions. What's the difference between bin Laden and 100 other young men who have woken up one morning and decided to change the world? One of the big differences was that he had a place to operate from with impunity for about 5 years, or really, if you trace it back to Sudan, more like a decade. And it's really quite rare for somebody with his ambitions to be able to sit around in plain sight and announce himself for so long, acquire the means to carry out his vision and not be challenged. Why did that happen? Well, their American foreign policy, I think, is part of the story in the 1990s. And yes, you can see the story of American foreign policy in the 1990s is rooted in its policies in the 1980s. That's also important. But I go back to this mystery to me about American eyesight of the Taliban. Really smart people with all sorts of different outlooks managed to persuade themselves year after year, even when they knew better, even when they said to themselves, we know better, that the Taliban could be negotiated with, that they would moderate over time, that they were just like the Saudis in the 1920s, that eventually they would see the benefits of making money and running a state and going to the United Nations. It was a complete misunderstanding of who Mullah Omar was and what his leadership shura was about and why he had the relationship with bin Laden that he did. And that and the policies that made that eyesight happen, I think, were the greatest contribution of American foreign policy to the events of September 11th, in my opinion.
David Gibson.
Your beginning remarks about whether the enemy is the individual or an individual or a state or the context. How should the United States react differently than it is reacting if, in fact, the enemy is the context? Because it seems the context, as defined by traditional nation states, are at least, if we are not to attack a nation state, that what they do within their boundaries, they can do whatever they like, then how do we ever get at the context of poverty and religious fanaticism? And, you know, so what should we do differently?
Well, I think you have to, fortunately for all of you, I'm not a policymaker, but since you ask, I think you start with a strategy based on a perception of what's the grave strategic threat. What's the grave strategic threat? For me, as a taxpayer, the grave strategic threat is the use of weapons of mass destruction on American soil by terrorist groups that have openly declared their intention to do so. So as a taxpayer, I would like my government to get up every morning and figure out how to stop that, because it's the only thing that could alter the course of the country that, you know, my children are going to grow up in, really. That there's no conventional military on the horizon that can challenge the United States. There is no means by which al-Qaeda using conventional weapons could seriously challenge the United States. They could challenge and demoralize the United States, but they could not in any way alter its course using conventional means. But the one thing they could do that would be the most devastating would be to carry out the ambitions that bin Laden has repeatedly announced in interviews to acquire and use particularly fission weapons, but other weapons of mass destruction if they were tactically plausible. All right, so if that's the strategic threat, then what is the vector of policies and perceptions that is most effective in repressing the potential of that ambition over the long period of time that would be required, 20 or 30 years? So that involves everything. It involves that is associated with that threat. It involves reducing access to fissile material. It involves challenging the context in which leadership groups like bin Laden and his immediate allies thrive. It involves reducing the potential for radicalization over a 20-year period, not so much of impoverished teenagers in North Africa, as serious as cell formation there is, but among metallurgists and nuclear physicists in places like Pakistan and Azerbaijan and elsewhere. So that is the part of the conversation that seems so far away in this election year to me as a sort of, as an occupant of the sort of self-defined center. The 9/11 Commission, Philip has left the room so I can say, I think was a minor miracle of the old kind of bipartisan sort of work that used to characterize foreign policy in Washington. It was two men, particularly at the top, who perhaps out of nostalgic sentiment for the bipartisan consensus that was present during the Cold War, insisted on working together to develop a strategy that they could both sort of embrace. And it's been criticized for being somewhat more vague than it might otherwise have been, but it represents the beginning of a conversation in answer to a question like yours. But I wonder on Thursday whether we'll even hear reference to any of this sort of thing. It doesn't feel like it. It doesn't feel like that's the cultural or political moment that we're in. That's
yes, sir.
Hold on just one second.
One
reserved
I apologize for another policymaker question, but the focus on the grand strategic threat then raises the issue of the complexities that you're pointing out, which is really just prioritizing what those threats are. And I think one of the things your book points out is that the focus on the grand strategic threat can then, once you overcome it, let the tertiary concerns rise to the top as the next grand strategic threat. So how do you prevent the situation where by creating policies to defeat the number one priority, you create the context that produces the next one?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and there's no button to push for that, other than remaining nimble and alive to all of the dynamism and complexity of a threat or a challenge such as Soviet communism or Al-Qaeda-inspired Islamic radicalism, transnational radicalism. I think that one practical problem that if you ever enter government, I'm sure you will confront, is the extent to which institutional momentum and bureaucratic self-propulsion ends up defining the answers to questions that bright people sitting around a table would approach in a completely different way from season to season if they had the opportunity, that there is a kind of inflexibility and a lack of nimbleness in the American machinery, partly because of its sheer size and partly because of the democratic system that we all value so much, but also unnecessarily at times, self-protecting, self-generating, self-defining over and over again. And anybody who's lived in a bureaucracy, as I have, recognizes that virus, but eradicating it in a system that turns over every 4 years is really a difficult thing. And I think a lot of this in the story. There's this unexamined momentum over and over again, same assumption, same thing. Just hand it off to the next guy and carry on.
Harry Taylor has lived and worked for American business firms in Southeast Asia. Harry?
Yeah, I also read your book, Ghost Wars, and enjoyed it very much. I thought it was extremely well-written and illuminating. through the thread of that book, I got the idea that the feedstock for al-Qaeda essentially comes out of Saudi Arabia with Wahhabism. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But over the last couple years, there seems to have been, and maybe over the last few months even more so, an attempt by the Saudi government to kind of crack down on perhaps precursors to al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia or actual al-Qaeda elements in Saudi Arabia. To what extent do you see them actually cracking down on the madrasas that, that kind of feed this, the radicalism that we see and that we're trying to fight?
Certainly to some extent, but how much is very difficult to judge from the outside. You know, Saudi politics reflects the traditions of a state that's very young, barely existed even 40 years ago. One of my favorite factoids about Saudi Arabia is that slavery was formally outlawed in 1962, and the government bought out Bedouin slaves. This is a very young political culture, and one of its features rooted in centuries of Bedouin tradition is accommodation of opponents. And so the initial instinct throughout the 80s and 90s, and particularly the early and mid-90s, when the royal family was confronted by bin Laden's stubborn dissent, which he enjoined with other dissident clerics and others, was to try to reach out, appease, isolate, accommodate them in place, not to confront them violently, and by doing so, put the credibility of the Saudi royal family on the line. The royal family is this huge, diverse institution itself, thousands and thousands of princes. They have all different views about how to confront the enemy. So for a long time, there was not a pattern of visible confrontation by the royal family against bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Once al-Qaeda started attacking inside Saudi Arabia and directly hitting installations of the and individuals at the heart of the Saudi state, a consensus formed, at least temporarily, within the royal family to take a harder line in response. And that's sort of where we've been in the last 6 or 12 months. Will that last if, as appears to be the case recently, they've actually broken up a lot of operational cells? Will they then go back to the sort of more passive approach that their system seems to produce in the face of such threats? It's such an opaque society and such an opaque politics that it's really very difficult to judge it from the outside.
Before we give Steve Cole wild, unbridled, enthusiastic applause and thanks for his appearance here, I'm going to let him start to leave the room so that he can prepare for the book signing. He will sign copies of Ghost Wars, which UVA Bookstore will have on sale in the outer lobby. Thank you all very much for being here. Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.